yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court is pleased to have argument here at the University of Texas School of Law, my alma mater. We, since the late 1990s, have traveled around the state and heard arguments at all of the law schools and other portions of the state of Texas, and we find it greatly exhilarating to this court to get out of our normal place of business and meet students and the communities and the opinion leaders around the state. What you're about to see this morning is what we do during at least 9 months out of the year, hearing oral arguments on some of the matters that we have granted argument on. It's a vital part of the process of decision making. Now, of course, we all have views about these cases, but we can be persuaded, and that's one of the reasons that we have oral argument, to talk to the lawyers themselves, let them answer the questions that remain after our consideration of the briefs and our discussion. So this is an open process, and but what you don't see is what goes on after argument behind scenes, unless you are fortunate enough to be a law clerk. We have great dialogue among our nine colleagues here about the outcome of cases, and there's a great bit of give and take after argument and during the whole process of drafting opinions. And so what you are seeing today is a small portion of what occurs when we decide the cases that will be submitted today. I want to make one announcement. Justice Medina asked me to mention that one of his interns this year, Omar Ochoa, is going to be editor-in-chief of the Texas Law Review, and the court congratulates you for that tremendous accomplishment. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080995, In re Columbia Valley Healthcare System, LP, doing business as Valley Regional Medical Center, and that is an original proceeding. Docket number 081066, Michael T. Jelinek, MD, and Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare, doing business as Rio Grande Regional Hospital, versus Francisco Casas and Alfredo De Leon, Jr., as personal representative of the estate of Eloisa Casas, deceased. And docket number 090236, the State of Texas versus KEW from Galveston County and the First Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will be taking a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in the first case, 080995, In re Columbia Valley Healthcare System.
May it please the court, Mr. Hashel will present argument for the relator. The relator has between 5 minutes for the question.
May it please the court, this original mandamus proceeding seeks to compel the disqualification of a law firm because it hired a legal assistant employed by the defense who had worked directly on the file, and then she worked directly on the file in her new employment. The facts are simple enough. Margarita Rodriguez was a legal assistant who worked directly on the underlying file for the defense law firm. She was hired by the plaintiff's law firm, and although she was initially instructed not to touch any files from her former employment, she ended up working on the file in several ways.
Mr. Hatchell, is there anything more that could have been done to rebut the presumption that Ms. Rodriguez shared confidence?
The oral instructions at the beginning of her employment are all that is in the record. And when she violated those instructions by her own admission, she violated them, she was re-instructed again. But there was nothing more than an oral admonition at the beginning of her employment not to, quote, touch the files or reveal confidence.
What more could have been done or should have been done?
Considerably more could have been done. This court has said in Phoenix Founders that in addition to the types of oral warnings that she was given, that the hiring law firm must employ formal, and I believe the court uses the word institutional, measures to effectively screen the paralegal from any contact with the suit. That brings into play what are traditionally known as the formal screening methods, which in this case could have taken a number of different forms. They should have taken a number of different forms,
What happens in a situation where you have a small law firm?
It's even more critical in the small law firm because the ability to have, quote, contact with the file is so much greater in this case. And the things that can be done are as follows. A memo can go out to all what we call in our firm the hot pink memo, can go out to everybody within the firm advising that there must this employee must be screened from this particular file. You can isolate the files under lock and key. You can put warnings on the files that this particular employee cannot be involved in that particular file. Those are institutional measures which go firm-wide and which I think can accomplish the formal screening that's done. And this is traditional through law firms, I think, throughout the United States.
Should there need to be some proof that the screening measures and precautions would have been effective? For example, if there's an employee who's not a lawyer who's hired a subsequent firm, and they just, notwithstanding precautions not to work on the prior files from the prior employment, they still do, even when they're threatened with dismissal, even if there are institutional measures. Should there need to be some at least argument or basis for concluding that those measures would have been effective?
Well, the court knows that it is promulgated a six-factor test by which the screening processes should be analyzed. But the situation that you have posed, Your Honor, which is a good one, poses the ultimate conundrum, and that is assuming that you do employ formal screening methods and the employee violates those screening procedures, as was done in this case. And bearing in mind that the screening procedures must be effective to prevent any contact with the file, on whose shoulders should the employee's violation fall? Should it fall on the defendant's shoulders, the former law firm, or should it fall upon the firm that employed the employee who violated the rules?
You alluded to some contact that she had. It seems somewhat minimal, placing the correspondence on top of a cabinet, rescheduling a docket control conference, and making a phone call, I suppose. Once you have that contact, is there no going back? In other words, after that, she was threatened with dismissal and what have you. Is that then not sufficient to ensure that there is no contact that would reveal a confidence?
Your Honor, I think the fact that she had the contact and violated the rules by her own admission means that there is no going back. At the end of my argument today, I'm going to suggest, in fact, in response to the question such as yours, that the test employed by this court in Phoenix Founders, Grant, and American Home need to be modified in some respects. But the ultimate answer to your question, I think, is that once the contact occurs, it has been demonstrated that the screening procedures are simply not effective.
And so in the context of a small firm, then, what do you suggest is appropriate? What measures would be sufficient?
I think the measures that I just suggested There has to be a warning, which is given not to reveal any confidences. There must be a warning not to work on the files.
And there was here, correct?
There was here, and the most important one, and the one which has been involved principally in the three cases that you have decided, formal screening methods that are effective to prevent any contact, which include firm-wide admonitions, not just to the employee, but to the entire firm, so that the entire firm can be involved in policing the contact with the file. The real problem, and I say with all due respect to opposing counsel, the real problem with what happened in this particular case is the fact that these particular policies that were implemented were self-policed or had to be self-policed by the employee herself. Here's what she said was the situation after the warning was received. If the case sounded familiar to me, or the style of the case sounded familiar, and then I was to tell him about it or notify him about it so that he could have someone else work on that case.
Well, now that was the general policy, but in terms of the Leal case specifically, how much weight should we give the confidentiality agreement? Because, you know, the new firm could look at that and determine she has signed a binding document to keep everything about the Leal file confidential, and why can they not take that into account in terms of how many further measures they need to implement?
Well, first of all, she violated it, and she admitted that she violated both that policy and the policies that were implemented when she came. The problem I have with their being able to look at that, and first of all, there's no evidence that they knew about
she
that.
You said she violated it by revealing a confidence or by touching making a phone call to schedule a doctor?
She did not, as far as this record shows, she did not reveal confidences. She said, she was asked a direct question, did you violate the policies that were imposed both at the former firm and this firm?
If she did not reveal confidences, then why go to the extraordinary measure of disqualifying the firm?
Well, because that actually has been the issue in all of the cases that you have decided. And,
sure.
And the court has said, you know, the battle should not be fought out over whether she reveals confidences or not. The battle is fought out over whether formal screening procedures are instituted.
But I'm interested in the policy rationale. Let's assume that it is settled. It's established that no confidences were revealed. Nothing from the former, from her work in the former case was revealed to the plaintiff's lawyers here. Why would we then disqualify that firm? This is a firm that the client hired that firm to do work. No confidences were revealed. So what's the policy rationale?
The policy reason is, there are two policy reasons, I think, for that. Number one, there has to be, in order to guide the bench and the bar to avoid disqualifications, there has to be a bright-line test rather than an ad hoc test that looks at each particular case. And somewhat in a similar vein, disqualification motions are a snapshot in time. And the fact that confidences may not have been revealed at the time of the motion for disqualification does not alleviate what this court has called the potential threat of disclosure as opposed to actual disclosure. It's that threat of disclosure that continues through the ability of the employee to have contact with the file that has motivated this court, and frankly has motivated the courts nationwide.
Does the appearance of impropriety have any effect on this?
Certainly one does not like to be in Mr. Nye's situation and have to pass on to your client confident of letters from the former legal assistant working on your file who is now working for the court. To me, that is puts the legal profession in a very, very bad light. Certainly, just as much as lawyers do.
We have to be a little careful so that the end doesn't consume the test for the means that we've set up. At some point, reasonable steps could be interpret it to mean ensure that absolutely no competences were passed on. And as we know, that's not the test. And there's a line that we need to draw there. And I'm not sure we can draw a bright line rule, hopefully a rule that's clear and can be followed. But
I think there's always
going to be some discretion there, isn't there? There's a continuum, it seems.
Your Honor, I would say that you've got to come as close to a bright line rule as you possibly can. Otherwise, we just simply revert back to a case-by-case situation. And bear in mind, as I said earlier, the goal seems to me to be to give the bench and the bar enough guidance to avoid these problems.
Well, let's assume that all the precautions you suggest and are required in our case law are followed, and yet a paralegal still discloses competencies. Well, under the existing law, the subsequent law firm gets disqualified, or does not get disqualified, because the precautions were followed. But the ultimate objective, precluding the disclosure of competencies, wasn't complied with. So we haven't really served the ultimate purpose in that case, have we?
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that that is what impels me to suggest to the court that there are one of two modifications need to be made to the existing case law. The first, I would urge the court to adopt the comment to Section 123 of the Restatement of the Law Governing Lawyers. That comment suggests that the irrebuttable presumption, which applies to attorneys, should also apply to paralegal personnel in situations in which the non-lawyer employee is assigned at the new firm to work directly on the same matter on which the employee had worked at a prior firm. I think that is a very appropriate test and one that is easily applied.
Isn't that the law in Phoenix?
A paralegal that actually works on
the same case in the rehiring firm is subject to the conclusive presumption that confidences and secrets were imparted during the course of the paralegal's work on the case.
No, that's confidences were acquired at the former firm. I'm speaking now of an irrebuttable presumption that confidences were shared.
In Grant, we suggested that the presumption could be rebutted.
There's no question that as of today.
So you're asking us to.
It is a rebuttable presumption. I'm suggesting that once we know that the employee has been assigned to work directly on the file, that the presumption should then become irrebuttable, as it is for lawyers. The second thing
that's
I would...
Let me make sure I understand. That's not going to happen. I mean, when someone has an irrebuttable presumption that they worked on a file of the firm they left, they're not going to be assigned to that same file with the new firm they go to.
Oh, but they were in this case.
No, they were not assigned to this case. They happened to have some contact with the file, minimal, but they weren't assigned to this case.
That's the question I have, too. I mean, you say there's no going back once she had contact, that it's game over at that point. But of the contact she had, how much of it was self-prompted versus directed by others at the firm?
Well, in at least one instance, we know it was directed by the attorney. She made copies from the file. Here's the list of the things that she did. She receives all correspondence in the file, and she places it for filing. She rescheduled a docket control conference, prepared an order, advised opposing counsel by letter under her own signature, copied a birth certificate and a social security card, and she is generally assigned to handle the calendar for the Leal case according to her own testimony, and according to her own testimony, she violated the very admonitions that were given to her. Your Honor, I had one.
I'd like to hear that second suggestion, please, counsel.
The Supreme Court of Nevada in Leibowitz versus 8th District Court has suggested, and it looked to the Texas principles for the rules that it applied as to non-legals, but it went one step further, saying that the hiring law firm must inform the adversarial party or their counsel regarding the hiring of the non-lawyer and the screening mechanisms utilized, at which point the firm so notified can file a conditional consent, unconditional consent for a motion for disqualification. I think that's a step forward, too.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the real parties in interest.
Okay, please report. Mr. Escobar will present argument from the real parties in interest.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Your Honors, I think I'd like to revisit some of the facts in this case just so that we have based upon what Mr. Hatchell was talking about, I think we need to have a clear understanding about what happened and how we were situated in this litigation. First thing I need the court to take under consideration is that the prosecuting file, if you will, the file that's being actively worked on was not at our office during the time that Mrs. Rodriguez was there. As the record reveals, Mr. Magallanes, who's the partner of the law firm, he suffered an aneurysm, and as a result of that and his prolonged hospitalization, the firm had to consult with other lawyers, and the file was transferred to Houston. So the active litigation file wasn't in our office. I know there's evidence that there's correspondence that we still received, but a lot of that was the carbon copy because we were listed as counsel.
Did she have any specific assignments, though, with respect to calendaring the dates? Like, specifically, did someone ask her to do
that? Well, Your Honor, I think in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. Yes, because, well, obviously, she's working for Mr. Magallanes. If this is a case that he's on, listed as counsel, then obviously she needs to know where he's at on the calendar. But I want to go back to the Grant case where the ultimate issue is there a threat that confidences will be revealed? And I think keeping on May 14th, for example, he's going to be in the Leal case somewhere. I don't see how, if she keeps that information on his calendar, that even comes near to making a threat that confidential disclosure will occur.
But it strikes me that this is a very rigid test. I mean, none of it is based on what actually happens. It's based on presumptions. So when you've got imputed knowledge of the former firm that is irrebuttable, and you go to the new firm, the presumption is that those confidences are shared unless it's rebutted. And what level should we require for rebutting? My understanding that the controversy here is whether additional measures were taken, and you agree that that's a requirement.
Well, obviously, Your Honor, it's the second prong of the test in Phoenix Founders, which is taking other reasonable steps to ensure that the person tainted with the confidential knowledge does not work in connection with the matters. And in this case, we told her explicitly not to work on the file, not to touch the file.
Well,
and
but you also told her to make a copy.
Well, that's correct, Your
Honor. It seems to me that that's the most troubling thing, is that by the lawyer asking the paralegal to do something with respect to the file shows to the paralegal that the lawyer's not serious about the screening.
Well, Your Honor, but what the law says is if there's a genuine threat to disclosure of confidential information, then disqualification is what the remedy is. Handing someone a piece of paper, can you make a copy of this, and handing it straight back while the supervising lawyer is there to see what she's doing.
Yes, but you've already told the paralegal, do not touch this file. Don't go near this file. Don't have anything to do with it. And if anything comes up, ask somebody else in the office to work on it instead. Unless I ask you directly. It seems to me that the paralegal takes away from that. This is not that serious.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree, because that level of conduct doesn't come anywhere near to a genuine threat that confidences will be revealed. It just doesn't. And that's the threshold issue here. In terms of the definition of work.
You're implying that a legal assistant like Ms. Rodriguez could make copies, do administrative work, as long as there's not an analysis on what the legal issues are in the file happen to be at that time, then that's okay?
Mr. Magallanes told her, don't touch this file. That is what the record indicates. We also had the file assigned to someone else where she was isolated from the file because she wasn't actively working on the file.
But then he told her to touch it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which way did he mean? That's the problem, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor,
don't touch it except touch it.
Well, what I'm saying is that level of conduct. She touched. I'm not backing away from that.
Right.
Those are the facts. What I'm saying is that it's a ministerial act. It's an act that doesn't require any substantive knowledge about any confidences or anything about the case. I'm handing
but
you
isn't
something.
That, isn't that just the dialogue we don't want to have to get into? What if what she had copied had been deposition testimony? What if it was, and isn't this just the debate we don't want to have to get into with these presumptions that apply? You had a rebuttable presumption, and if there's been a contact with the file, then why shouldn't it be that the burden to rebut the presumption just wasn't met?
Well, Your Honor, because we have another level of protection involved in this case, and that's the confidentiality agreement. There was a binding contract between her and the prior firm, you know, wherein she explicitly and expressly agreed that she would not reveal any confidences with respect to her prior employment.
But again, it's presumptions. And don't we have a more difficult problem when the prior, you know, so often you have a former employee where the knowledge is imputed to them, even though they never worked on the file, it may have been in another department. Here, she worked on this file and had actually confidences. Don't we have to apply a stricter test on the back end when she goes to another firm?
Your Honor, I have two responses. The first one is, yes, we want to respect what the law requires, and we feel that we did that. We assigned it to somebody else. We told her not to do it. And I understand, as Justice Hecht has made light of, I mean, obviously that was something that I guess would be regrettable, but it doesn't rise to that level. But the other thing that I want to talk about in terms of presumption, Your Honor, is that there's a binding contract. And I would argue that the contract, you can rely, you can presume on the contract. And in this case, we have evidence where she was asked direct questions and under cross-examination, she said she complied with the terms of the contract with respect to the not revealing any confidences. I think the testimony that Mr. Hatchett was talking about was whether or not she, quote-unquote, worked on the file. Now, obviously, she had contact with it, and initially what I wanted to do is talk about that issue, because what happened in the facts of the case is that...
And I'll let you go on.
Sure.
But the problem I have is it strikes me that the jurisprudence is such that it doesn't really matter what happened, and it doesn't really matter that someone says, yeah, but I really didn't know anything or I didn't say anything, that the reason for these presumptions and the test for these presumptions is so we don't even go there.
Correct. I understand that, Your Honor, but I'm saying I would argue that there's another presumption involved, which is the contract. So you can presume that the contract is the firewall, the Chinese wall, the level of protection between her and the revealing of confidences. And you can rely on a contract. I mean, this court...
But if you can't rely on her to follow the instruction that is don't work on this file, how can you rely on her to honor the contract? It seems to me that once you break one thing, the presumption is torn down.
Well, Your Honor, I understand. I mean, she did disregard our express instructions.
So why wouldn't she disregard the contract, too?
Well, because you're
her employer. This was just her former employer.
Right. Well, but the evidence is, Your Honor, there's no evidence at all whatsoever that any confidences were revealed. And obviously, we're going to try to do everything we can to isolate her from the file, exclude her from activities on the file. But, I mean, unfortunately, those are what the facts are. And I just, my argument is that those ministerial acts that she performed don't rise to the level where you would have a genuine threat that confidence would be
revealed.
Well,
counsel, that's the grand thing. It seems like if you have the people on the other side, the Columbia Valley Medical Center, who have lawyers that have been exchanging work product and expert witness information, if you ask them if there's a general threat of disclosure, they're probably going to be pretty upset about this. So it seems like we have, I mean, a systemic problem here. Your law firm hired someone that apparently you knew had been working on a file and had these confidences. You did not get a permission from the other side. You did not go and ask, can we hire this? Is there a problem here? So it seems like that the general threat depends on who you ask. If you ask someone who's being sued, if the other side can have a paralegal who's worked on that file, they might probably legitimately think there's a general threat of disclosure at some point.
Yes, Your Honor, but you're making light of a subjective standard.
I'm not making light at all. It's a pretty serious business. If you've been sued, or if you were suing them and one of your paralegals went over,
if you told your client that that paralegal that had been working on the file, getting your expert witnesses ready and all that, is now working for the other side, they might be pretty upset about it. They might think there's a real threat about it because this is their only lawsuit. And so it depends on who you talk about. Is there a threat?
I understand that, Your Honor, and I agree with you that, of course, that they would have reason to think that. But we're dealing with what the record says on an objective standard as to whether or not the confidence were revealed or not. And you measure the record by what...
We're not talking about whether confidence is revealed or not. We're talking about whether you rebutted the presumption. And it sounds like you're saying, I can rebut the presumption by having a swearing match over whether confidences were revealed or how substantive the contact was.
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that we fulfilled both steps under Fink's Founders, which is we instructed her not to work on the file, and the other steps that we took is that we had this whole scenario where another secretary in the office that was working on the Leal file.
As to the reasonable steps, though, there does seem to be somewhat troubling that after you instituted additional steps, you continued to instruct her to have some contact with the file and allowed her to do so. So even on this record, how can we find that you took reasonable steps when persons at the law firm directed activity?
Your Honor, that was one instance. That was to make a copy of the birth certificate and Social Security card, I think is what
so you're asking. It seems like you're asking for a carve-out.
I'm sorry?
You're asking for a carve-out. If you had a bright-line test through your discussion here, that you would carve out administrative type of functions that aren't significant.
Your Honor, I don't think the test has to be modified at all. The test is there a genuine threat that confidence will be revealed? And what I'm saying is that conduct that she had in this case doesn't rise to that level.
Well, there's always a threat. You're sort of putting it on the paralegal, and she may reveal them no matter what steps you took. I guess the issue is, did you take steps that were reasonable and to prevent her from doing so? The threat, I think, will always be there anytime you hire someone that's worked on both.
The answer is yes, Your Honor. I believe we took reasonable steps because we told her not to work on the file. We isolated her from the file by assigning it to a completely different secretary in the office. And the facts that I wanted to get to initially was that this docket control situation. The other secretary, Mrs. Scottsville, who was in charge of the Leal file, was already on the phone doing another DCC. She was unable to take that call. So she had asked Mrs. Rodriguez, well, you know, don't do the docket control conference, just reset it. And that was how that contact occurred. She wasn't going to do the docket control conference. She was just trying to reset it. And I know we may be splitting hairs about it. And yes, if you know, rescheduling that, she did all the ancillary tasks related to that.
It seems to me that perhaps the firm did take reasonable steps to preclude her from being involved in the file with the exception of make this copy and maybe a few other things. But it takes me back to the same question I asked Mr. Hatchell. What about the appearance to the other side on, well, here's someone sitting at counsel's table, perhaps, maybe not, but that was involved. And just like Justice Johnson said, you get the appearance that, you know, we're getting hosed here at trial because there's somebody that knows the facts of this case for the other side.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because the law requires that we rebut the presumption. And the trial court had the evidence not only of what we did, but also in reliance on the contract that they've got. And I just think that, you know, this court has enforced all sorts of contracts with respect to, like, arbitration agreements. And, for example, in re Prudential Insurance case, that was a waiver of a jury trial. I mean, that's a constitutional right that someone's waiving by contract in a lease agreement. Well, we're not talking about a constitutional right. We're talking about whether or not someone, by virtue of a contract, can keep confidential things that they agree to keep confidential. And
what's the standard of review here that we should?
It's an abuse of discretion on with respect to whether the trial court properly applied the law or not, Your Honor. That's what the standard is here. And the Reed Barber case that I cite in the brief says the court can have conflicting evidence before it, but as long as there's some evidence to support its decision, then that's enough.
Counsel, we appreciate your candor with regard to the facts in the record. Sometimes they're difficult facts and folks don't address them head on. We appreciate that. There's a question that comes up, and I know we're not dealing with children here, but any parent, when you tell one of your children, don't do this verbally, and then they do it, you know, if you just tell them the same thing again, that may not be too effective. why weren't there steps beyond just a verbal warning after the first infraction, or were there?
Well, there was, Your Honor. The evidence in the record reveals that after Mr. Mayanos was informed that the secretarial staff had done what they did, he had a meeting with both of them, and he told them that under threat of termination that you cannot engage in this conduct again.
That's another verbal warning, right?
Under the ultimate sanction, which is you're going to lose your job if you do this again.
So it's a stricter verbal warning, but still a verbal warning.
It is a verbal warning, Your Honor. But let me talk about that. I know Mr. Hatchell is saying you need to have, like, for example, the confidentiality agreement and the memorandum that's attached to my brief. I mean, those are written policies. And for whatever reason, Mr. Hatchell says, because you have a written policy, that's going to make a difference. I don't see what the difference is if it's not really whether it's in writing or not. It's the knowledge that the policy has. And we spoke to her face-to-face, Mr. Mayanos did. He talked to her about it, so he's able to look at her to see whether or not she's comprehending what he's telling her. That's what happened here, not only at the beginning, but the second time.
And how about some other procedures to isolate the file? Like there was some suggestion of color-coding the file or some other mechanism for letting everyone around this particular legal assistant know that that's not a file she should be anywhere near. Was anything else like that done?
Your Honor, other than what we directed her to do and invite diverting the files, and remember, this wasn't just about the Leal file. We told her any file that she worked on, any file that she, for whatever reason, thinks that she's familiar with because of her prior employment, she has to punt that out of her purview. She's got to get that away from her. And that was in a general sense that we said, and we also addressed it in a very specific sense because they talked about the Leal file. But again, Your Honors, I feel that because, you know, we did demonstrate at the trial court that we complied with a two-prong test under Phoenix Finder, and then we have that other, that the contract provides another layer of insulation in this case.
Let me make sure I understand the analysis. If let's say that there had been a lock on the file cabinet and everything was color-coded and everybody had written instructions to keep her from the file. But then the same things happened here. Your argument in terms of the legal analysis would be by having the procedures in place, the presumption of shared competences was rebutted. And the de minimis nature of the contact isn't sufficient to defeat the overcoming of the presumption. Is that what your argument would be? I mean, I think what Mr. Hatchell is going to say is if you've got the measures in place and there's any evidence they were breached, then the presumption goes away. I mean, the fact that you've overcome the presumption goes away.
Right. I know that's what he's arguing, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is we've got something else that no other case has, which is before she even came to work at Mayanos y Hinojosa.
But that doesn't matter because if you've got it's in a lockbox, even with the confidentiality agreement, all the lockbox around it, if it's still breached, then all of the lockbox and the confidentiality agreement and everything that was attempted is irrelevant.
Well, Your Honor, but the ultimate issue there, and I keep harking back to it because I think that's what the law is there a genuine threat that she would reveal any confidences? And in this case, you don't have any evidence of any confidences ever being revealed. And that is the ultimate test. That's the Grant case. That's what everything was measured by. And what I'm saying is, although it is regrettable that she had contact, as the facts reveal, we met what the law required of us in terms of isolating her from the file, instructing her not to work on the file, and so forth.
So, Counsel, if the shoe were on the other foot, you'd be perfectly comfortable under the same circumstances but reversed, that one of your former employees was over there at the other firm making photocopies of files, even so, that sort of thing. That'd be okay with your client?
Your Honor, I don't know if it would be okay with my client, and I would suspect that it wouldn't be okay with my client, but we're governed by what the evidence and what the law requires.
But your client would be satisfied with the fact that you can say, well, but there's no genuine threat of confidentiality being breached.
Why?
That satisfy your client?
I understand that, Your Honor, but you know my client's feelings don't have anything to do with what is required in the law. And although they may disagree with it, although they may feel upset about it, the record in this case doesn't get us to the point where I think disqualification is appropriate.
Well, but
because
that,
we're able,
but you know, that's, we're here about protecting clients. I mean, it's not your law firm, it's not the other law firm, it is the clients. And in that regard, let me ask, do you have any comment on Mr. Hatchell's suggestion that one way to kind of reduce some of these problems is to, when you hire someone, have a disclosure to opposing counsel, the opposing party, that you hired and what your screening processes are, those suggestions that he made. Would that somehow be a problem insofar as implementing something like that?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Phoenix Founder case speaks to that issue, which is the court, one of the public policy issues that the court relied upon in making the decision was you don't want to limit or confine the ability for these people, that were, the secretaries, for example, to be mobile in terms of where they're going to apply for a job. Brownsville, I mean, Brownsville, Texas is not Houston, it's not Austin. It's a lot smaller.
That's why I'm asking you. You have a small firm, and you have maybe a small community of legal assistants and paralegals. What kind of a problem do you see if that were to be implemented?
Well, because I think it would have that effect, Your Honor. If we were to pick up the phone and call the opposing counsel saying, hey, we know so-and-so used to work with you, we're thinking about hiring, is it okay to get client consent, basically?
Here, and we're putting these procedures in effect, and here's the firewall, and here's what we're going to do.
Well, I just don't see a way that the opposing firm would ever agree to it, because obviously their interest is, well, I don't want that to happen. I mean, obviously that's what I think that's where you're going, Your Honor. But what I'm saying is the way that I can address it is to say that this court has already said you don't want to limit the ability for the secretarial pool in whatever economy be limited because of this rule. I mean, for example, Mr. Knight's firm or Mr. Goldman.
You've answered the question. I think I understand your position.
Are there further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel. Court will hear rebuttal.
May it please the court.
Mr. Hatchell, is that going to be the practical effect in a smaller community, small number of paralegals and assistants, that you're going to simply put them out of work if we institute some of these procedures that you've suggested?
Well, I think, quite frankly, I think that it fosters confidence in collegiality. If the court were to adopt the...
You're presuming that exists.
It's one of the things that I certainly decry about the profession, but I'm an optimist. Mr. Justice Johnson, I really think that the smaller the community, the more upfront you are. You know, I think your practice was a smaller community. Mine was from Tyler for many years. We had to see people every day and over again throughout the year. And so I think that the adjustments that I'm talking about actually will foster collegiality and certainly will not put people out of business. It will instill much more confidence in the system.
Assume you have a screening process in place, like you discussed. If the legal assistant at the second firm receives, you know how you have global email routing, you know, the email to every employee in the law firm.
Right.
If the legal assistant passively received an email pertaining to that case, would that disqualify the firm? In other words, how technical are we to get on these standards?
Well, that's an interesting question. When you say passively receives, I like to go back to this court's ultimate test, and that is screen the paralegal from any contact with the suit. I don't know how you start judging the questions of contact.
So the receipt of the email pertaining to that file would disqualify the law firm, right?
If it were not intended for that particular employee, but was something that was read, I guess it depends on the substance. Here's the problem that I have with things like this.
We then start getting back into a fact-specific, case-by-case, ad hoc, anecdotal.
So maybe it should be just an irrebuttable presumption instead.
It's what I'm suggesting should be the case when it is proved that, at least when it is proved, that the employee actually worked on that
paper. And then you wouldn't have to worry about screening.
That's correct.
Would you think that's the best policy for lawyers as well? Do away with screening and just have an irrebuttable presumption?
Well, of course, I think that that is the rule with lawyers today. There's the double.
Well, we got. We're in the process of looking at disciplinary rules.
Yes.
There was a project from the ABA,
and
part of that is a very intricate kind of screening mechanism.
Is.
At least in that proposal and in some states. But do you think the better policy would be if you have received confidential information? Then if you go to the next firm, that firm would be disqualified from representing.
Yes.
And legal assistance.
I'm a firm believer in the double imputation.
And secretary?
I would have no problem with the double imputation as to legal assistance because the only...
How far down does it go? Legal assistance, secretaries, janitorial staff, runner?
Happy staff.
Maybe so.
Okay.
Because the only articulated policy from this court is we are concerned about the mobility of legal assistants and non-legal employees. Well, in my observation, the mobility among lawyers is equally as great as that among, perhaps even more so, than it is among non-legal personnel.
But what about smaller communities? There are a limited number of jobs and there are a limited number of legal assistants, so you really are sort of hampering their ability to get a raise at another firm if you implement such a rigid rule.
I disagree with that. I think you're actually, as I said earlier, fostering confidence and collegiality if you are very upfront, as was the case in the Leibowitz case.
In a litigation setting, do you really foresee law firms sort of agreeing that the former employee can now come to this firm and you know, we're all going to agree to get along?
I do see that, Your Honor, because I've experienced it myself. I transferred from my own firm to a 700-person law firm and encountered many of the same situations, all of which were worked out quite amicably. And I think that that's the Leibowitz case is a roadmap for being very upfront, very transparent, working these things out at the beginning so that the threat of disclosure can be heard.
If we change the law to adopt an irrebuttable presumption that you're suggesting, then your second suggestion to inform opposing counsel of the hiring, that letter in its second paragraph would say, and we're disqualified from this case.
Yes.
In every instance.
Yes.
And how could this have been worked out, as you say, if this paralegal had wanted to go work at the firm and... but they knew about this case.
Yes.
What would be the workout?
Yes, the way that is done is pretty much as it says in the Leibowitz case. First of all, you put your screening things in place, and
no,
then
I'm
you
sure.
call the other, and then you call the lawyers when you identify.
I understand there are going to be no screening. It's automatic. So let's presume that's the world we're mm-hmm. talking about. Tell me what could be worked out in that sense.
Then what you do is, I mean, if you're facing an automatic disqualification, you can always seek from opposing counsel either an unconditional a waiver of all screening or a conditional waiver, which would be to implement screening processes. And in the Leibowitz case, you say you need to be advised of what those are.
Have you signed any of those in your career?
Yes.
Limited?
Yes. I'm subject to those now as we speak.
Do you think that's a realistic option?
Yes.
And all those are by agreement with opposing counsel?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, there's formal screening of me of some cases, and there are also agreements that were worked out as to particular cases, yes.
So even with an irrebuttable presumption, with agreement by the other side,
yes,
that presumption would not preclude...
That's correct. I mean, this happens to lawyers now because we have the double imputation of irrebuttable presumptions, and yet lawyers work out these matters all together by agreeing to specific screening techniques. And that's done very collegially. I recognize that in some cases it may not be, but I would say that the good faith of lawyers probably carries through, and most of those are worked out quite well.
Are there further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heschel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.
Thank you.